You're tuned to 90.7 KRWG Las Cruces. I'm Leora Zeitlin. This is Intermezzo, and it's my great pleasure to welcome back into our studios Mark Kossauer, principal cellist with the Cleveland Orchestra, and soloist for the third time with the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra, and Lonnie Klein, the artistic director of the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Kossauer, we've had the pleasure of talking a few times before, I think, but let's talk a little bit about your background, because you grew up in a musical family.
That's right. I grew up in a family of cellists. My father's a cellist, and my older sister's a cellist, and both professionals. And I heard cello music before I was born in the house. And when I started playing at the ripe age of a year and a half years old, my father was really overly excited because he heard me humming back something that he was practicing while I was in a play area in his office, because my mother worked sometimes too. And it went from there. I participated in the local chapter of the Suzuki program, which was there was a very strong and large program in Eau Claire, Wisconsin at that time in the late 70s. I grew up primarily studying with my dad, also studied with some cellists in the Twin Cities area, Janet Horvath of the Minnesota Orchestra, Tanya Romanikova at the University of Minnesota. And so I had Starker and Rostropovich background. In addition to my father, who is a lineage of the former principal of the Cleveland Orchestra, Ernst Silberstein.
Wow. So was there no question that maybe you would play a different instrument? It just had to be cellos in the Kossauer family.
Exactly. I think everybody was brainwashed. No, cello was it. And my father's also an organist, so we heard a lot. And so I also took some piano lessons and things, but cello was it. And I knew when I was 4 years old that I wanted to be a professional cellist.
Wow. And your sister? Did she continue with it?
Yes, she did. She's a professional cellist now, although we have her on tape when she's 2 years old saying that she didn't like the cello and would rather play the harmonica.
But life didn't turn out like that.
No, I think she liked it after that.
Wow. So there are some other cello families, but not many. And I've told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again. The Finkel family, David Finkel, his uncle and 2 cousins were part of a family that lived in Bennington, Vermont, and I went to Bennington College, and they were all cellists, and his aunt was a bass player, but they had David and his 2 cousins, Chris and Michael Finkel, and his uncle, George Finkel, had a 4-way music stand built that was beautiful hardwood, you know, with 4 sides, and then they would sometimes all get together and play these cello quartet
I should mention that my family was no exception, although we didn't have the music stands, but we actually, my father had a concertizing career and played quite a few recitals and things, concertos sometimes too. And so when my sister and I were old enough, he used some of his contacts, and based on his previous performances, they started hiring us, and so we became known as the Dolce Cello Trio, and we played a lot in particularly the upper Midwest part of the U.S., but we also played a few other places, went to Europe once, and played for the second American Cello Congress for a reception for Mstislav Rostropovich, and at which point he came up to my mother after we played, and he said, "Make more cellists."
Wow, that's a great story. So you mentioned mentioning your father in the lineage, and I was thinking actually about that very term and idea on my way over here today. Music is a lineage tradition, and it's one of the few professions left where you really you have this one-on-one relationship with your teacher, if you're in conservatory or in the university, you know, for those years, and but often for many years before that. It's different than any other kind of study. There's even the other arts, which used to also be apprentice. It's no longer the same way that you have a few teachers that you've really worked with. So I'm curious to your thoughts on now also being a teacher now and carrying on the lineage that you've come from in terms not just your biological family, but your musical teachers. Janosch Starker, we talked about him in the last interview because he had just passed away that week, but also Joel Krosnick, I think you studied.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, so what you inherited from them and what you give to students as your link in that lineage?
Well, Starker always talked about his teaching as being the most important of all of his activities, because he said he always looked at it exactly like you just described, from a lineage, from a historical context, and it was the greatest way to influence the future of music and the direction of music was passing on the knowledge and information you've collected, not only from your teachers, but from your own investigations and performance experiences. And so I early on was very interested in teaching. Both of my parents were teachers, so it's in the DNA too. But I realized right away it was a win-win, because you got the pleasure of helping somebody else, and at the same time, it made you better at what you did, having to articulate, you know, precisely what somebody needs to do in order to correct a problem or to enhance what they're already doing. And so I knew early on, meaning in my college years, that I also would spend most of my life teaching as well. And so as I've grown older and have had more experiences, I really am seeing. It's just really rewarding seeing how if whatever I can do to not only help somebody, you know, learn an instrument and not only to become a better musician, but also to you'd influence them personally too, in terms of what music can do for you as a human being.
Yeah, and also because of that close relationship where you're one-on-one with that student, musicians often talk about their teachers having taught them about life. But I'm interested, I often ask people, you know, give us a story about your teacher, and we did that in the last interview, but tell us a story about something you've learned as a teacher, or how it changed something in your playing.
Well, there are many stories I could tell. I can talk about a particular student in that I currently have and have been working with for the last number of years a star caliber student. And star caliber students are often a little bit different in that they come to you and there are lots of things that are already working very, very well. So you have to think twice about, you know, how you approach them, because you want them to keep playing as fantastic as they're already playing, but at the same time take them to, you know, higher levels. And so I think this particular student has forced me to take, you know, different approaches. Of course, I approach every student somewhat differently anyway, but really from a different angle. And I think by doing that and being forced to do that, because that's, you know, what's working, it's just added another dimension to what I'm doing as a teacher. So
All right, let's segue into the Elgar, which is the great cello concerto you're performing this weekend with the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra, the Elgar Cello Concerto, written in the 20th, well into the 20th century, although we think of him as a Romantic era composer mainly, but I think he wrote this after World War I, and a massive work that really came into its own decades later, I think, with Jacqueline Dupré making a very famous recording of it. And I guess it was played before that, but it seems to me that the 60s was when it sort of
blossomed. Right, that's when it became quite famous with the public. There is an incredible recording of that concerto, however, from the 40s with Pablo Casals playing. Mm-hmm. And I am always drawn to that recording, because as what happens with a giant like Jacqueline Dupré, as they put their stamp on a piece, and which kind of affects how that piece is viewed from then on. But if we look, the Casals version was interesting to me because it was very different from the Dupré version, and to me was equally as valid and as captivating, and perhaps even more because Casals was the supreme musician to ever play a cello. And it has been verified by, you know, people who were alive and heard him. It's amazing. It's also amazing that the premiere of the concerto was a total flop.
Yeah.
Because the conductor wouldn't give enough rehearsal time to with the orchestra for a premiere, a new piece nobody knew. And so it was received very poorly. And because of that, really wasn't performed very much for the next 20, 25 years. And like you mentioned, didn't really achieve international fame until Dupré performed it. And
yeah, so sometimes we don't know what posterity will do for work. So Elgar didn't have that pleasure. I know, I think I read even that his wife or somebody wrote a letter right after the premiere.
Yes.
And was just furious and lambasting the conductor.
It was his wife, yes.
Yeah, Elgar's wife. So it's a long work. Isn't it?
Well, it's 25 minutes in length, which is
longer.
No, that's a pretty fairly standard length concerto, but there's a few interesting things about it. It's in somewhat in cyclical form, in that you have this sort of head motto, main theme in recitative fashion at the beginning of the concerto, and that comes. It starts also the second movement in a different form with pizzicato in the solo cello and an outline in the orchestra, and then of course it comes back at the very end of the concerto, and having traveled through this incredible journey and takes on a whole new meaning, and the piece is all in circles. I mean, so many of the melodies, they circle around, but they always kind of return to a similar place. And to me, that's a very symbolic of fate. Mm-hmm. And, his wife was fading away at the time he wrote this piece and was very ill and died 6 months later. And so I think, he felt and they felt time was running out. And it's also interesting that she really propelled him to be a composer of magnitude, and was a great inspiration for him. And upon her passing, he never wrote another significant piece of music.
Mm.
And he lived 14 years past her death, and he really didn't write much of anything.
Yeah, they seem to have had a wonderful, wonderful marriage. There's this very famous, beautiful little love song that he wrote, I think, as a wedding gift to her, Salut d'amour, that's played a lot on the violin. And it just seems like the ultimate romantic love letter of music. And their marriage lasted like that, as a very loving relationship, which is really sweet. Lonnie Klein, director of the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra, what's your perspective on the Elgar Cello Concerto?
Well, it's a new work for me. I had never conducted it before, and Mark and I had talked last year, and we had done the Schumann, and I've done the Saint-Saëns, and we've done the Rococo variations. So he suggested, well, think about the Elgar. Actually, I did the Herbert as well. I said, well, I haven't done that, and it's something that, I'm interested in doing. And, of course, Mark said, well, I haven't played it a lot as a soloist. He's done the concerto, but he said, not a lot with orchestra. I said, well, let's do it in Cruces. So I love it. It's a beautiful piece. It's got some gorgeous melodies, and there's a real connection with the soloist and the orchestra. I mean, we really have to be together. There's so much rubato, there's so much tenuto, there's so much giving and taking of the music, and sort of back and forth with the orchestra. Mm. So it's a challenge. It's not technically as hard as some concertos, but musically it's a real challenge, and that's sometimes just as hard as playing something that's very technically demanding.
Absolutely.
To make it fit, music out of it.
I love the idea that the circular quality to it is a kind of fate motif. I always think of fate motifs like Beethoven and Tchaikovsky symphonies, where it's, this knocking on the door. But circles in music are very common. There's rondos and all sorts of ways in which the music naturally comes back. But it's not that common in an entire concerto.
That's true. And another thing I think that makes it such a great piece is you really have the contrast between these great declamatory and recitative statements that the orchestra and especially the solo cello makes, which is basically shows Elgar's public side. And, he was regarded as this, upper-class English gentleman, the perfect member of upper society, and yet he was from a very poor background and was self-educated and was Catholic in an Anglican country, and so and then people considered that he married higher than his, you know, social status, and so these were differences that he never, that he always struggled with in his life. And so then on the personal side, he had these conflicts, and he was a very eccentric man, at the same time, I think because of these irreconcilable forces in him, that he was always filled with this sort of insecurities, you could say. And so then we have this private music in the concerto, such as the third movement, which is very intimate and heartfelt. And you have also the struggles when the fog and the sea rolls in again in the last movement, after this, you know, a lot of English jokes and upbeat heroic music. And then you have this, something that sounds like it's out of a Wagner opera a little bit, and with this incredible harmonies basically it's like a swan song, you know, this last heroic outbursts. And he really did regard this, I think, although it's always debatable, but I think in a catalog after this concerto he wrote, you know, Fine, that was it. I think he wrote.
Another interesting aspect in terms of form, as Mark talked about the recitatives, but there's really no cadenza in this concerto. Huh. So you get the recitatives, but, I mean, I don't think I know any concerto that doesn't have an extended cadenza. Like, we just did the Beethoven violin concerto, and we had three extended cadenzas.
Yeah.
Almost as long as the piece.
Right, which is very, usually very an unique opportunity for the soloist to sort of show off virtuosic technique and whatnot. And when you say recitative, meaning a sort of a statement that the cello makes or the orchestra can make.
Rhetorical statements, right.
Yeah. And in this case, I think it's just really a bridge or a link to the next movement.
Well, so we've heard then it's a concerto with a lot to look forward to, lots of different moods and beautiful concerto. And the concerts Saturday night at 7:30 and Sunday at 3 with the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra, and an open rehearsal tonight. Lonnie, just a couple words about the Eroica Symphony. We can't end the interview without something about
Beethoven.
Well,
my former concertmaster Michael Goldman said you can't go a season without playing Beethoven. And I thought that's very, very true, actually. And last year when I was thinking about this program, I thought, you know, we haven't done the third in 7 years. And that's long. I mean, I've done other Beethoven symphonies, and it's a powerful symphony, obviously, with the name Eroica. So many unique things about the symphony that the audience will enjoy. This extended development section, the first movement, six themes. Obviously, the theme and variations, there's 10 variations in the final movement. There's just so much to this symphony that the audience, I hope, certainly will enjoy it, but it's a powerhouse.
Yeah,
I think it's a real kind of good bookend to the Elgar.
Yeah, two massive, magnificent works. An interesting program. Well, I want to thank you both for coming in. Lonnie Klein, conductor of the Las Cruces Symphony Orchestra, and the soloist this weekend, Mark Kossauer. It's great to see you again. And the concerts again are, there's an open rehearsal tonight at the Atkinson Recital Hall, tomorrow night at 7:30, and Sunday at 3 o'clock. Thank you both.
Thank you.